Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Haunted History. I'm your host, Megan, and every week I'm going to be taking you on a little journey through our world's haunted history. I actually have some very exciting news to share. We are hosting our very first giveaway. That's right. We are giving away a $500 Amazon gift card to one lucky follower. How good would an Amazon gift card be? Especially with Christmas right around the corner, you could get a head start on your Christmas shopping or just treat yourself to a little something special because you work hard. You deserve it. Entry is very simple. So all you have to do is visit our new Instagram page at Haunted History Pod. Click the post that says giveaway and then follow the instructions in the caption. So it's super easy. We are going to do the draw and announce the winner on a quick Instagram live on Halloween night, October 31st. And we'll keep you updated through our socials on what time we're going to be doing the live so that you guys don't miss it. We really appreciate all of our listeners so much, and we thought that this would be a really great way to give back. And it also won't be our last giveaway, so make sure you stay following our social media page so that you don't miss any updates. And of course, I'll be announcing them on here too. Now, let's get to today's story. A lot of us remember the scene in The Exorcist. You know the one where, and this is a spoiler alert, Linda Blair's head does a 360-degree spin as she's being exorcised by a priest. Many scenes from the movie are seared into our collective minds. And at the time, the movie as a whole had a huge impact on cinematic culture. The idea that demons can possess a person isn't new. Many ancient cultures held the belief that evil spirits could enter the human body and make us do things that are either beyond our capabilities or just downright evil. And just as many cultures believed that an entity could occupy a person, they also believed that the spirit could be forced out. So today, we tell the story of the real-life exorcism that inspired the famous movie, as well as another, maybe lesser-known instance of a real documented exorcism. It's 1949, and we are at the Mount Pleasant Library in a suburb of Washington, D.C. A minister named Reverend Luther Miles Schultz clears his throat before addressing a small group of people before him. The people staring back at him with bated breath are members of the town's Society for Parapsychology. In the safety of this group, locals can meet up and discuss elements of the human condition that defy scientific reasoning. Today, the minister has a story for everyone, and so he begins his tale of a local haunted boy. He recounts in January of that year, a family from nearby Maryland had experienced strange events in their suburban home. Scratches emanated from the house's walls, and eerie phenomena seemed to plague the family's young boy, a 13-year-old only referred to by the name Robbie. The bed in which Robbie slept would shake violently, and objects such as food and wall hangings would shudder and fall to the floor whenever the boy was near. Reverend Schultz took a pause and reminded his audience that he was a skeptical man. Nevertheless, he arranged to stay overnight at the boy's house so that he could monitor these strange occurrences. He stayed in a room and watched the boy sleep. At first, said the Reverend, all was quiet, all was normal, but then it began. Vibrating sounds began emanating from the bed, scratching sounds echoed from the walls. A pallet of blankets moved inexplicably about the room. The minister chuckled at this, recounting that he had, at that moment, asked the boy to stop, believing that he was the source of the strange manifestations. And this, dear listeners, is the first account of the story of the possession and exorcism of a 13-year-old Maryland boy that would be commonly identified as Robbie in the media. Later, he'd be known by the pseudonym Robbie Manheim. Published by the Washington Post on August 10, 1949, the story would evolve and gain a life of its own before being seized upon by a 20-year-old English major named William Peter Blatty, who would later write the novel The Exorcist, inspired by these events. Before we continue with Robbie's story, we should first touch on some key concepts that drive this tale. Now, much like last week's episode on the Salem witch trials, the fear that drives these events wouldn't exist without the religious beliefs that cement certain phenomena as truth. That is to say, according to the Catholic Encyclopedia, demonic possessions are real, and as such, exorcisms are real too. When chronicling Robbie's story, for example, Father Robert J. Spitzer states, in a matter-of-fact tone, that there exists 8 common paranormal manifestations of a demonic spirit observed in nearly every culture in the world. These 8 are poltergeist activity, levitation, excessive weight of the individual, telepathy, remote movement, destruction of religious objects, understanding and sometimes speaking unknown foreign languages with proficiency, such as Latin, Hebrew, or Greek, knowledge of the personal secrets and sins of the exorcist and exorcism team members, and lastly, appearance of dark figures, animals, insects, or other apparitions. Another concept that should be noted is that at the time when our story plays out, it's the 1940s. Mental illness was still deeply misunderstood, and sweeping the misunderstood with the paranormal wasn't unheard of in order to make sense of the world. All right, back to our tale. Robbie Manheim was born on June 1st, 1935, in Cottage City, Maryland. He was raised Lutheran. As a distinction from other branches of Christianity, Lutherans do not believe that salvation hinges upon being baptized. Robbie was an only child, yet he found a companion in his Aunt Harriet. Harriet, for her part, identified herself as a spiritualist, and she would routinely toe the line between our world and the so-called invisible world that we spoke about during our last episode. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, the invisible world is basically the spirit realm, the unknown energies of our world. So Harriet would often use a Ouija board in order to communicate with the dead. Now, I'm sure most of you are familiar with what a Ouija board is, but if not, I'll give you a quick rundown. A Ouija board is a flat board with all of the letters of the alphabet and the numbers 0 through 9 and a yes or no painted on it. With the help of a dial called a planchette, you're supposedly able to communicate with spirits beyond the grave. Playing with a Ouija board is commonly referred to as a séance. On a night in January 1949, Robbie began hearing some strange sounds. First, phantom dripping sounds were heard, although no taps were running in the house. Next, tapping beneath the floorboards boomed through the house. Father Spitzer, in his retelling, states that a picture of Jesus rattled before becoming dislodged from the wall, as though some unseen force was pounding from behind the wall. Strangely enough, Harriet passed away on the same month that the disembodied sounds began overtaking Robbie's house and life. Let's not forget that Robbie was an only child, and his aunt was also his friend and companion. So in order to contact her, Robbie made use of the Ouija board once again. This illustrates, perhaps, Robbie's childish approach to death. In mourning his aunt, he sought to communicate with her using the object that has a direct connection to her, so this only amplified the strange occurrences. What's more, paranormal activity seemed to follow Robbie, as it was reported that once his desk lurched inexplicably in his classroom at school. While visiting a family friend's house, it was also reported that the rocking chair that Robbie was sitting on spun upside down and twirled around on its own. Robbie's parents, who are also only referred to by their pseudonyms, Carl and Phyllis Manheim, were at a loss. They had witnessed for themselves the inexplicable phenomena that seemed to plague their son. And when the family turned to their fellow Lutheran minister, Reverend Luther Miles Schulz, he had bluntly stated that Robbie was not possessed and that he was a normal boy. The Manheims urged the Reverend to spend the night at their house, which takes us back to the opening scene of this story. After his night at the Manheim residence, the Reverend was convinced that Robbie was in fact possessed by a demon. And who else could tackle this problem, he reasoned, but the Catholics. He urged the family to seek out a Catholic priest, as they have more recorded instances of dealings with possession than any other faction of Christianity. In February, the Manheims contacted the St. James Parish in Maryland. They spoke with a young, inexperienced priest named Father Edward Hughes. After explaining their situation, Father Hughes patted them on the back and sent them on their way with a vial of holy water and two blessed candles. The demons did not like this, as poltergeist activity seemed to spike once these holy objects entered the Manheim home. Father Hughes was urged to come visit Robbie himself, which he did. Upon visiting Robbie, a curious thing happened. As the young priest chatted with the boy, Robbie suddenly switched from speaking English to full-on Latin. This was highly unusual, as Robbie was not familiar with the language. Father Hughes immediately pushed for an exorcism, which was granted by his superior, Archbishop O'Boyle. In March of 1949, at the Georgetown University Hospital, the first of many exorcisms was taken on Robbie Manheim to rid him of the demonic presence inside him. Now, keep in mind that our main source material for today is an account by a fellow Catholic priest, so it's already coded in the belief that demonic possessions are real. For the purpose of the exorcism, Robbie was restrained on a bed in a small room, isolated from the other patients. As soon as Father Hughes started the exorcism, it was reported that Robbie's bed moved straight across the room and slammed into a wall. Robbie then began cursing at Father Hughes. Strange markings began materializing on the boy's body. In a horrific twist, Robbie had freed one of his arms while Father Hughes was praying out loud by his bedside. Robbie then grabbed one of the loose bed springs close to him and proceeded to slash Father Hughes' arm from his shoulder to his wrist. It's said that the priest needed 140 stitches to sew up the wound. Now, following this incident, the Manheims reportedly relocated to St. Louis, Missouri, and sought the help of a group of Jesuits, led by Father Raymond Bishop, in order to treat their son. Starting on March 16, 1949, Father Bishop, alongside Father William Bowden, Father Vantou, and seminarian Walter Halloran, performed no less than 30 exorcisms on poor Robbie. I won't walk you through each exorcism today, save for one distinct moment that's been chronicled by Father Spitzer, in which, a month in the process, Robbie received the Holy Communion. It's said that it was at that moment that the boy began writing in pain and the word exit appeared on his body. Now, apparently, the culmination point of these exorcisms was the moment that the voice of Saint Michael himself spoke through Robbie and banished Satan from the boy's body. Robbie, it's said, was right as rain after this. He received the Holy Communion, apparently converted to Catholicism, and notably has no recollection of the events between January 1949 and April 1949, the full span of his demonic possession. So what can we make of this, dear listener? Well, for one, many of the more salient points to this story, although delectable to us, are more or less hearsay. It appears that the original story, our opening scene, if you will, was true. Reverend Luther Schultz did speak at a meeting for the Society of Parapsychology. However, it seems that a cryptic game of telephone was played in the following months and years, with layers of ghoulishness added to the story with every recounting. However, it is very true that this story truly did inspire William Peter Blatty to put pen to paper and write about the demonic possession of Regan McNeil in The Exorcist. You see, Blatty was a student at Georgetown University, where Robbie's supposed exorcisms took place. In his book titled Possessed, The True Story of an Exorcism, Thomas Allen writes that the general consensus was that Robbie was just a deeply disturbed boy. This draws certain parallels to last week's episode, as one of the theories about why the young girls in Salem had sudden fits could have simply been chalked up to mental illness spurred on by their difficult living situation. In a very extensive examination of the truth behind Robbie's story, author Mark Opsasnik says, quote, "To psychiatrists, Robbie suffered from mental illness. To priests, this was a case of demonic possession. To writers and film and television producers, this was a great story to exploit for profit. Those involved saw what they were trained to see. Each purported to look at the facts, but just the opposite was true. In actuality, they manipulated the facts and emphasized information that fit their own agendas. End quote. This quote perfectly encapsulates the overall sentiment surrounding the case today. That being said, we did say that we would round out this episode by touching on another instance of documented exorcism. One other notable modern example of an exorcism is that of 23-year-old German woman named Annelies Michel. Annelies, who was a student teacher in 1976 when her ordeal began, was deeply religious, raised in the Bavarian town of Klingenberg. She was known to suffer from epilepsy as a teenager and had received psychiatric care in her younger years. For 4 years, Annelies received medical care for depression. Unfortunately, when it was becoming clear that she was not getting any better, Annelies and her parents began to settle on the idea that it was an outside source that was incapacitating her. As such, they went from the hospital to the church. A local parish priest, a man named Father Ernst Alt, diagnosed Annelies as being possessed. Father Alt, along with another priest named Father Arnold Renz, would be instructed by the Bishop of Würzburg to carry out the formal rites of exorcism, with the help of a 360-year-old liturgical book of the Roman Catholic Church called Ritual Romanium. The exorcisms, brutal, one-hour sessions undertaken in the basement of her parents' house, lasted for 11 months. By the time Annelies' ordeal was over, she weighed merely 68 pounds, and she ended up dying of starvation and dehydration. The priests had recommended that Annelies fast in between rites. Both priests, as well as Annelies' parents, were convicted of negligent homicide. It was even stated by multiple doctors during the trial that Annelies essentially died from a combination of epilepsy, mental disorders, and an extreme religious environment. In other words, religious fervor was kind of the wind that stoked the fire, if you will. In court, both of the priests that exorcised Annelies remained steadfast in their belief that the young girl was, in fact, possessed. Her parents, on the other hand, while maintaining that they too believed she was possessed by a demon, insisted that Annelies was yet to be freed, even in death. After a nun told them that she had a vision that Annelies' body was still intact, her parents ordered her body to be exhumed, only to find out that it had gone through the natural decaying process. The exhumation process had attracted hundreds of spectators, and ultimately shows that Annelies' parents were not facing the reality and true nature of what their daughter's plight had been in life, nor in death. When The Exorcist came out, it in itself was a phenomenon. There are documented cases of what's been coined cinema neurosis following the release of the movie. Cinema neurosis is described as the development of anxiety, somatic responses, dissociation, and even psychotic symptoms after watching a film. Because it was the first of its kind in terms of special effects and storytelling, almost following a documentary style that truly immersed the spectator, The Exorcist left a generation of unexpected moviegoers traumatized and delighted. The idea behind the psychiatric breakdown that some people experienced following the viewing of the movie was essentially that witnessing Reagan's possession play out in the form of unapologetic lack of impulse control would have ultimately triggered susceptible people to do the same. This is very fascinating and a little bit meta, as, well, a movie about possession essentially caused people to act possessed. We now know, however, that theirs are symptoms of unchecked mental illness and that treatments to curb these temporary fits do exist. Well, that's it for me this week, friends. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Give the show a follow so you don't miss an update, and we always appreciate ratings. They give us the support needed to improve our show. Have a lovely week, and I'll see you all next Tuesday.